Fixing hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an FU commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part two.
Hi, I'm Taylor Hall. I just want to let my family know that I'm okay, that I'm safe. They're providing me with food and water. I'm looking forward to playing out the rest of the season. Go Yotes.
Oh, I don't have a character here. I don't know. I'm Kevin Ball.
I'm a big, tall guy. You could be John Chayka. Yeah, you'd be John Chayka. You could make references to
video games. Well, I just said I'm the other guy, so it's too late now. Drones. John, you say the guy you are.
And I'm the GM of your favorite team, and I didn't make a move because it's December and it's too early and it's too hard to trade.
You're in Puck Soup. I believe, Sean, the phrase you're looking for is you kept your powder dry.
Yep.
That was a phrase that
gotta
I saw bandied about.
Keep your powder dry, man. You gotta keep your powder dry. C-minus yeah. prospects are going to pay big minutes on the third line in 5 years. And
hey, one of them is a B-minus prospect, so get your facts straight, buddy.
Is keep your powder dry a reference to gunpowder or snow or cocaine?
Well, it could be cocaine. Although I don't think you get...
If it's coming out of Edmonton, it could be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep your powder dry, Evgeny Kuznetsov. So it sounds like you think that other teams should have maybe anteed up more for Taylor Hall and been a bit more aggressive about these things, huh?
Not even necessarily that. I mean, we never know how these things happen behind the scenes. Obviously, the Devils wanted to make their move, and if the Coyotes had the best offer, then that's how it goes. I just kind of roll my eyes at all the immediate reaction from media and a lot of fans that, oh, thank goodness my team didn't do anything and just kept the status quo. Which in a lot of these cases, the status quo is not good. And yet people are, I don't know. I wish my goal in life is to someday have a job where as many people want me to not do my job as NHL GMs, but still get to keep my job. I probably have a lot of people who wish I wasn't doing my job, but that want me to still be employed, and I could just occasionally be like, guys, my job's really hard. I don't feel like doing it today. And people would be like, we absolutely get it. Try again, maybe at the end of February.
That makes total sense. Like, that would be the dream actually when you're applauded for it. And again, like, I don't know where the worm turned, but like, wasn't it used to be a thing where you'd see a trade and you'd see how much a team gave up for some dude, and then you'd be like, fuck that, why did my team make that deal? It seemed like with the Taylor Hall thing, and I don't know if it's specific to Taylor Hall because of the injuries or because he's obviously going to go to July 1st or whatever, it just seems like there wasn't a lot of people that like mad that their team didn't offer up 2 fourth liners and a prospect that could maybe be something. Plus a one and a three.
Yeah.
Like, people weren't upset about that.
So I think part of the reason is you got to look at the market, right? Like, St. Louis, they needed Taylor Hall because they don't have Vladimir Tarasenko. But also they can go, well, shit, we won the Stanley Cup with a bunch of guys that nobody thought were any good, like, this time last year. So, you know, we can probably get by without Taylor Hall, you know, next guy up and all that shit. Edmonton. Mm-hmm. What fucking difference does Taylor Hall make? Who cares, right? Like, I mean, that's not going to be enough to get that team over the line of being like a legitimate cup contender. Like, it might get them into the playoffs, which is, I guess, technically not wasting a year of Connor McDavid's prime. But
can I say this though about Edmonton? Like, isn't one of their big problems the fact that you have two guys that are responsible for the vast majority of the offense? I know they've been trying to play McDavid, Draisaitl, and Nuge like up the gut, but wouldn't Taylor Hall on one of those lines like make that line exponentially better and maybe give that team the balance that it needs? Like, wouldn't that be the play?
I mean, it needs a lot. Like, of course Taylor Hall helps, but like they need more NHL wingers than just Taylor Hall. You know what I mean? Right. And that's the real problem. Yeah,
exactly.
Although, hey, now we're talking about Zach Cassian getting $4 million next year. So, you know, he's got as many even strength points as Connor McDavid. Okay, or Austin Matthews was what I saw Austin last Matthews. Night. And it's like, I wonder how many points Austin Matthews would have if he played with Connor McDavid. I think it would be more.
Yeah, indeed. All right, so the trade was 5-for-2. The Coyotes sent Nate Schnarr, and I'm Schnarr sounds like the kind of generic canned goods that you'd find in a Walgreens, like Schnarr brand.
That sounds like some shit Kevin Smith made up that he thought, like, that a bunch of fucking boring idiots were, like, saying for 15 years. Snoochie, whatever the fuck. Sucks.
Schnarr the Gnar.
Yeah.
Nick Merkley. Now, Nick Merkley's good, but he was always hurt, right? Am I right on that?
He's supposed to be good. I think he was a former first round, or I guess was a first round pick. People get mad when you say former first round picks because he just was one. But, injuries are the problem there, and, you know, maybe that's hindered his development more than you would expect.
And then there's Kevin Ball, B-A-H-L, and he is like 6'7", or some such, and he was drafted by the Coyotes, and people were like, he's not that good. And then I've heard people say that he's gotten a lot better, and I've heard people say, no, he's still quite bad.
I think the answer is kind of somewhere in the middle from everything I have seen and heard of this player. Basically, it's a thing of, he's probably an NHL player. No, he's never going to put up any offense at all. But if you need a guy to kill a penalty, he can be, the fifth or sixth defenseman on your roster who does that.
Okay, for Blake Spears and Taylor Hall, which means in 6 years we'll be calling this the Blake Spears trade. The thing about the package, and of course the first and the third. The thing about the package for the Devils that I find interesting is that from everything that we've read, and Pierre LeBrun had a good breakdown on the Athletic of the field for Taylor Hall as a rental. It seems like that Ray Shiro went into this knowing he wanted to get a defenseman. Got to get a defenseman. And, the Avalanche weren't going to give up Bo Byram. Edmonton wasn't going to give up their young D. And so in the search for a defenseman, it became, okay, well, let's just make this deal and get Kevin Ball, which I find ironic because the whole reason Taylor Hall ended up in New Jersey was because of, I just need to get a defenseman.
Yep.
So that's all. Time is a flat
they
circle.
They should have tried to get Adam Larson for him.
Oh, yeah. Do we like this trade, Sean?
I can certainly understand why, if you're a Devils fan, it probably feels a little underwhelming. We're kind of conditioned to, there's the old Sam Pollock, whoever gets the best player in the trade, and that's not only is Taylor Hall clearly the best player here, he's probably the only player that a lot of people have heard of in this trade. When you've got a guy he's an elite guy. He was the MVP a couple years ago. You would expect this to be one of those kind of windfall trades that we still expect, even though they don't often happen anymore. Like, you look at what happened with Eric Carlson. You look at what happened with Mark Stone, guys like that, Matt Duchene. You tend not to get these huge packages back. Especially when a guy is a rental, and it certainly seems like that's the case here. Like, I think there was a bit of a market correction I don't know if I'd say market correction, because that implies the market may have been in a different place, and maybe it never was. But just in terms of the perception, I think people realize that this is going to be a very tricky deal to do long term. It's going to be a deal that probably won't happen. You probably are renting him for a year. The timing was interesting. Often, the longer you wait, the higher the price will go for certain teams, but also other teams might drop out and Taylor Hall could get hurt and any number of other things. So the timing was interesting to me. I certainly don't think it's a home run for the Devils, but I see why they did it under the circumstances and why they felt like this was good enough to get it done and move on and not necessarily roll the dice that you could wind up with more in a few months, but you could also wind up with less or nothing at all, depending on how the circumstances play out.
Right. Yeah. And they looked like super geniuses after one game, after what Taylor Hall did in that game against the Sharks, which is fun. Sneakers liked it, too.
Yeah, putting up some offense against the Sharks has been pretty tough for a lot of guys this year. So,
hey, Arundel played really well in that game. I think the one thing for me in this whole situation as a Devils fan is I've really come around to understanding what the summer was. The summer, for a lot of people, they looked at it and they said, oh, this is a gambit to try to keep Taylor Hall in New Jersey. You know, look, we can get you a shiny, slightly used PK Subban. And look, Nikita Gusev is here for offense things. And Jack Hughes can be the Robin to your Batman. But I think the more I think about it, the more I think that they kind of maybe knew he wasn't going to stay. And this was much more of a Columbus gambit than it was a let's impress Taylor Hall and have him re-sign gambit. What do you think about that?
That could be true. I mean, like, I think we've all known this whole time that they were counting on him going to free agency just because that has seemingly always been his stated goal is to test the market
right.
And, you know, get his $10 million a year or whatever the number ends up being. And well within his rights to do that, and that's great for him. But I think it was a thing of, like, partly what you said of just trying to, you know, maximize his value now while you definitely still have him, but also be like, then look what we're building for the future too. So maybe you do want to stick around. And, like, maybe he did want or does still want to stick around, but, you know, but it was just, he was always going to go to the market. So if they struggled, you know, the Devils are in a cap position where they can trade a lot of fucking guys and get some value. And you know, if they don't get Taylor Hall back in the summer, you know, well, you know, they have the cap flexibility to kind of, you know, make some things happen elsewhere in the summer instead now.
Do you guys think that Ray Shiro should still be the GM of the Devils? It's a conundrum, right? Like, I mean, if you look back at his draft history recently, like, there's some obvious wins because he had the first overall pick. Jesper Bratt was good. They've done a kind of a shitty job, I think, developing younger players. And, I mean, teams fucking is going to miss the playoffs in four of the 5 years that he's been there. And now it looks like they're back in another rebuild for at least 2 years. So, I mean, he won the Taylor Hall trade, let's be honest. But should he still be the GM?
Well, he took over a team, you know, that needed rebuilding. So I don't think there's they've only made the playoffs once in 5 years. Like, first of all, they shouldn't have really made the playoffs that year. Like, you know, that was just kind of a fluke thing that I don't think very many people expected. And also, like, making the playoffs shouldn't have been the goal for most of those 5 years, if not all of them. So, you know, I can't hold that against him. And, you know, if you want to talk about the longer term roster and player development, like Mackenzie Blackwood's not what everybody kind of thought he would be yet, and that kind of thing, like, that's more of the question. I think, you know, winning and losing games, like, who gives a shit if you're supposed to be bad this whole time?
Yeah, but right. But it's been 5 years though. Like, that's a really long time to be bad. Even
like this bad,
like, and to still be back to where you started. I mean, like, there have been some really bad teams that have there have been really bad teams that have gotten good a lot quicker than this, and there have been really bad teams that have stayed bad, and they don't have the same GMs in pretty much every case. So,
and you needed Taylor Hall to basically win the Hart Trophy in the span of 3 weeks to even make the playoffs the one time you made it, and you made it as the last wild card, then you got your asses kicked by Tampa. Like, it's not good. It's like,
no, it definitely
it's not a
isn't.
Good stretch.
I don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not defending him, but I think that, you know, it's a question of what his bosses think the goal has been this whole time. Because if the goal has been to get picks and prospects, well, he's certainly done that. But if the goal is to be competitive, I mean, you know, you cannot reasonably argue that they've been anything close.
Yeah, and he's won two lotteries, which isn't something you can give credit to a GM for or bank on as a as a future strategy, especially now that you don't have Taylor Hall anymore.
For sure.
And like we talked about before, like you're either going to become the Oilers, or you're going to become the Penguins. Like it's you're either going to have this collection of amazing high draft picks that don't amount to anything for a while until you get like a generational talent, or you know you compile all these picks and then eventually get there. I wonder how much of this is on Jack Hughes and what he becomes. Like, you know, is he, what's his upside to the point of we look back at this and be like, oh, okay, they have two of the main building blocks of Stanley Cup life and Hughes and he sure up the gut for the next decade. Like they need a defenseman, they need a goalie. Like how much of this is contingent on Jack Hughes? Oh yeah, no, that's all you need. I'm just, that's the building blocks of life, sir. Haven't you ever taken biology? Two centers, stud defenseman, goalie worth a damn, you win a cup.
Right. Well, that's right. All. But what I'm saying is they're halfway there and they are now short on the two hardest positions to fill of those things. Like a franchise defenseman and, well, maybe not up. Like you could, if Mackenzie Blackwood's like a 918 goalie behind two high quality centers and a defenseman, like, okay, maybe, but yeah.
Corey Massasek points out that Mackenzie Blackwood now has a 948 save percentage since the coaching change, and the Devils play at an 85.5 point pace when Blackwood gets the decision.
Cool.
Strap a Rocketeer back to 7 points out of the wild card.
Yeah, remember last year when people were like, well, Mackenzie Blackwood has just as good of a save percentage as Carter Hart. Cool, okay, great.
Are the Coyotes a playoff team?
Yeah.
Sure looks that way.
Like cement them in playoff team, or you're using permanent marker, or using like a marker that you could use a Mr. Clean
a
dry erase
washable.
To get rid of.
Crayola washable for sure.
Yeah. So not etched in stone, maybe just like chalked on the stone a little bit.
Yeah, they need to get more proof of concept with this offense before I can say, you know, because right now they're really a goaltending only kind of a team, you know, like they're not doing a ton otherwise. And can you count on one or both of these goalies being this good all year? I mean, maybe, but it's dicey for sure. So
you can't get in 23rd or 24th in offense.
No.
I mean, I can't see a path to it. I don't know. I found it interesting that when they made the trade, everybody was immediately like fucking over a barrel talking about the Coyotes being a potential conference contender. And I'm like looking at the standings and they're like two or three points up on the last wild card.
Yeah.
Like it's a lot yet to be determined. And I think a lot of it doesn't necessarily have to do with the Coyotes. I mean, like
they get the benefit of a dog shit, division though.
They do. I mean, like you figure for the sake of upward mobility, like the Flames could go on a roll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Vegas is rolling. I mean, Edmonton, we're kind of seeing what they really are. The Canucks are probably a wild card team at best.
Yep.
And, you know, unless the Sharks, fuck, I don't know. Like
they're
the
way
Sharks
too deep out now, I feel like.
They're really way too deep out, but they're still a team that like can put together fucking, you know, 8 wins in a row. Like they're kind of streaky like that,
yeah.
Even though I don't think they're good.
Yeah, no, they definitely have talent, but it's the putting it all together and I'm also not a Bob Bugner fan, so
a Bob Bugner.
I think it's the right time for the Coyotes to take a swing at this.
I agree.
We all looked at that division going into the year and you're like, man, Vegas is amazing, Calgary's coming off a great season, San Jose is clearly still going for it, and now we're 30 games in. Like this isn't, we're not overreacting to a couple of weeks in October. This we've been going for a while now. The division is not good. It's right there, and it might not be there next year, but it's there right now. And it, you know, it's kind of a little bit like the Columbus situation last year. Like at some point you got to give your fans something. And I know we're always, you know, we're always talking about, oh, the Arizona market and do they have, Is it the right market? Do they fill the building? And then as soon as you say that, someone else runs in and says, oh, but if they're not making the playoffs, you can't judge anything. You can't judge. Okay, So then sometimes you got to make the playoffs, and you got to actually, you can't just sit there and finish 10th every year in front of half a building and have no expectations.
Mm. Half a building, very generous.
You gotta, yeah. Thank you. You got to take a swing at some point, and you know, same with Columbus, right? Like it was, you know, at some point you got to win a round. Like it's been 20 years, man. Give your fans something to sink their teeth in, make a few new fans. And it's the same sort of thing in Arizona, and the timing matters. And I think you can make a legitimate criticism that for Columbus last year was the wrong time, even though it, you know, worked out okay, at least for one round. I think this is the right time for Arizona. And the fact that, you know, John Jacob probably doesn't have 5 years of patience to put this all together is part of that too. But this was, even if it is just a 1 year rental situation, this was probably the right time to take your swing.
Yeah. I mean, they're never going to have a better shot.
Yeah. I do wonder about, you know, when you start hearing about the owner and, you know, private planes and shit coming to get Taylor Hall and throwing money at Hall and throwing money at Kessel and everything. Like, I think Chake is on solid footing there. They seem to get along and stuff, and he seems to be heartily endorsed. He got a new contract and stuff. But, you know, would it shock you to see billionaire owner try to hire big name cup winning GM at some point?
I love that that's criteria that they get along. That's such an NHL. They get along. Well, they enjoy golfing together. So really, the fact that you missed the playoffs like 8 years together. In a row, no biggie.
But that's how nepotism works, you know?
Now, a Stanley Cup winning GM, I'm trying to think if there's any ones who maybe are in a little bit of job trouble right now. Just Stan Bowman.
Oh, I was thinking about somebody else.
Who are you thinking about?
The great Roman warrior Centurion once said that the LA Kings are the greatest team that's ever
been
put together.
You could have also met Jay Feaster,
by a well-coiffed man.
Is what I'm thinking.
Jay Feaster.
By the way, up to apparently in the finalists to run the AHL from now on, Jay Feaster.
That's good for Jay Feaster. Jay Feaster
saw that this week,
and I mean this is no insult. Whenever I see Jay Feaster and I think of Jay Feaster, I think of Wayne Knight from Jurassic Park. Is that wrong?
I think of going for it, where he's just like, you know what, we have this. Not even as good as the current Chicago Blackhawks roster, and we're just going to try to squeak into the playoffs so we can get absolutely fucking demolished by the Red Wings. It didn't work somehow. Incredible.
Who are the most random GMs that won a cup?
Ooh. Oh man,
Feaster's on that list.
Oh yeah,
right. Maybe top of the pops of that list. I'm trying to think. Who was the GM when Colorado won?
Pierre Lacroix, I think, was the
guy, right?
And they, I think he was the GM for both. So, I don't know.
Yeah. So that'd be one. Who was the GM? Was it Gainey, the GM in Dallas when they won?
I think you're right about that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, most guys aren't too random. Like, most guys, they win, and it's like,
you see
okay,
it more with coaches.
That guy's been around the block.
How about this one? Peter Chiarelli.
Yeah.
Oh, pretty fucking random guy to win a cup.
The thing about it is that, like, history may show that he's just a one-hit wonder. Like, that's his
that's his
Blair Witch project, if you will. But you have to give him credit for how he built that team. Like, he gets that.
Yeah, and like Jay Feaster barely had anything to do with building that Tampa team. You're right about that, I guess. But yeah. I also don't know enough about like the building of the like 1996 to 99 Dallas Stars to know how much Bob Gainey was involved in that. So,
Well, just wait for the Athletic oral history.
Yeah,
so on the way.
Where's Taylor Hall going next? That's the question.
I don't know. Who has $11 million and needs a 28-year-old winger? That's the real question, right? Like, it's going to be a team with a shitload of money.
Are you not saying that there's not going to be a Tavares-level courtship of Taylor Hall this summer?
I think teams are kind of smartening up on that.
No.
Like, well, A, because he has the injury history now a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
B, because, you know, he's not having a good year. So, you know, and see, because he's not a center and you know, like Tavares spent a lot of time being, oh, he's one of the most underrated players in the league. I think everybody properly rates Taylor Hall as a borderline elite winger having a bad year and coming off an injury.
And the winger thing is key. I mean, what was the market for Panarin at the end of the day? It was like four teams, maybe? They were going to pay that
money? That's the thing. You only need that many. You don't need eight teams.
Yeah, you need two. You need two, or one
that thinks there's two. That's all you need.
Yeah.
And we're told that there were seven other teams in on Taylor Hall from a trade perspective, including some that were looking to do hockey deals, which is interesting to me because that suggests that, you know, these are teams that maybe were reluctant to part with big chunks of the future. Some of those teams would have purely been looking at him as a one-year rental, but I think that if he plays well the rest of the year, and that's a key, you know, if he stays healthy, if he plays well, goes into the playoffs, does something, I think there will certainly be at least three or four GMs who can talk themselves into a, you know, hey, I was willing to give up this, this, and this to get him a few months ago, so now I can get him for nothing but cap space. Oh, that I'd have to do that. And B, there will always be some GMs out there going, you know what? Given this guy 8 years is crazy. There's no way he's going to be worth it in even 4 years. But if I don't get this done, I'm not going to be a GM in 4 years, and it's not going to matter. So I got to sign this guy, give myself a few more years on this job, and then the years 5 through 8 will be somebody else's problem, most likely. So
And like you have to think he wants to go to a team that's pretty good, right? Like the idea of him signing with Columbus because they have the cap space.
He wants to go to like Boston, like or St. Louis,
right? But he also wants to make a shitload of money, and that's where it becomes tough.
What about the Islanders? Like, do you think
who's a team that's good and has cap space to
burn?
I think
the Islanders with the new arena come in, a GM who's impatient.
Yeah, they're one that immediately springs to mind.
I can see that. The other one that kind of comes to mind, and I'm kind of half laughing as I say this because I just feel like they're going to be the runner-up, is the Montreal Canadiens. Just, you know, Marc Bergevin's under some pressure. The season isn't going great. Obviously, it could turn out well, but especially if they miss the playoffs. There's good, and just they're always in on every big player, and it's been more of the centers, so this would be a shift, but I almost feel like Marc Bergevin has to get in on this, even if he doesn't win the bidding war, just to show that, you know, look.
And Marc Bergevin going like, but what if we converted him to center, just like he does with every fucking winner in the league?
Oh, the next Juan, here he is. Yeah, I could see that happening. That seems like the kind of team that he'd want to play for, too. Are we discounting the idea of an Edmonton reunion? They finished what you started gambit from Taylor Hall.
Where are the Oilers getting this cap space?
They got a ton of cap space next year, dude. They've got like fucking a dozen UFAs.
But don't they have to re-sign a couple of key – like Darnell Nurse, isn't he up? Or he is. Maybe that's like next year?
Here's my thing. If you're the Oilers, if you're willing to go – 8 years on Taylor Hall in the summer.
Well, it would be seven.
I guess you're right. Yeah, 7 years on Taylor Hall in the summer at a big cap hit and all of that. Then you got to give up the B-minus prospects to get him now, because Connor McDavid is about to turn 23. This is you have been given a certain number of prime, full-powered, healthy Connor McDavid seasons. You don't know how many you're going to get. You've already wasted a bunch of them. You've got one more right now happening. And to just kick the can down the road and go, you know, we're going to hold on to our prospects and then just do it, like, do it now. Now is when you should have done it. If you're willing to commit to this player long term and you think he's the answer.
If they don't make the playoffs this year, I think it's grounds for contraction. Just contract the franchise, let Connor and Draisaitl go where they want to go. Like 31's an odd. Well, we're going to go to 32 now with Seattle, so 31 is still an odd. I guess contract the Oilers and then
just
expand,
get
them
out of Edmonton,
to Houston.
Get them out of there.
But it's the same like management and ownership team. You have to cut the heads off the Hydra first.
That's true.
So contract them and then put a new team in Houston, because new teams are fun. Like everybody wants to be with a new team, you know. That's why Pete DeBoer and Mike Babcock will probably sit on their hands for a while to see if they can go and play in the Seattle sandbox.
Yeah.
Who would want to do that? What do you think of the Maurice stuff, by the way? You see that stuff? Like,
that was odd.
People assuming that the connection between Ray, I mean, it's Ray, between Ron Francis and Maurice is one that's strong enough where it's obvious he'll hop over from Winnipeg to go be the Seattle coach.
He was asked about it and he denied it, but didn't really deny it. Like he said very positive things about Winnipeg, said, I want to be here. I'll be here as long as they want to have me. This is where I want to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But he didn't say like, no, I don't know where that report came from. Yeah. I've never had a conversation. I've never even thought about it. This is stupid. I'm nipping this in the bud. He gave kind of a thoughtful answer. And it's one of those things where like his contract is up, I think this year. So when you say I'll be here as long as ownership wants to have me, well, what does ownership wanting to have you look like as far as the next contract, right? Like they could come to him and say, hey, 3-year extension, and he could say, yeah, double my salary. And they go, no, we're not going to do that. And he goes, oh, I guess you don't want me. And then he hasn't lied, but I found the answer very interesting. And I'll give him credit because how many times would somebody have just said no truth to the report and just lied right to everyone's face about it?
Yeah.
But he didn't do that. And he certainly didn't, you know, he said all the right things about wanting to stay in Winnipeg and yet did it in a way where at the end you're like, oh, I feel like that door is still cracked open a little bit.
You could count on maybe one hand the number of coaches that wouldn't want the Seattle job. After seeing what happened in Vegas and all these guys being fucking creatures of ego and they're all little baby Dr. Manhattans that want to create life. Like, all these guys would want that gig.
I don't think any of the coaches are black, Greg. That stupid show sucked.
Well, he was. I mean, he put himself in a black man's body. Oh. I don't know why.
Me neither. Great question.
Oh, spoiler, by the way. So, like, who would Bruce Cassidy wouldn't go?
No,
that's it. Maybe, maybe. I mean, would Mike Sullivan go? If Ron Francis walked up to Mike Sullivan with a glowing briefcase and was like, "Look, I have a way for you to get out of your contract with the Penguins and take over this new team," would he go?
Yeah, I mean, get out while the getting's good. That ship ain't staying afloat much longer, right? So
maybe just Bruce Cassidy would be like the only guy that I could think of that wouldn't want to go, and Gallant, obviously, because he's pretty happy in Vegas. Maybe Quenneville. Maybe Quenneville's in his sunset days and just wants to be at the beach. But other than that, show me the guy that doesn't want to go to Seattle.
Barry Trotz? He's got a good thing going on the island.
I think any of the new guys. I don't think Sheldon Keefe's leaving his buddy who just ate $25 million to put him in the NHL. But
yeah, that's true. He can't leave.
Any of the newish guys are going to stick around and finish the job. But other than that,
okay. What about Jeff Blashill? Do we think he's sticking? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Finish what he started.
I'm pretty sure. So definitely Rick Bowness would go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bob Bugner. Yeah, I can't think of a guy that wouldn't go. Outside of like maybe 3 or 4.
I'm just looking forward to when Ron Francis hires Bill Peters. And it's just like, there you go.
I've had so many discussions with people in the last couple weeks about like, or at least in the last week after the Crawford letter came out, about they're all like, oh, look, that's the way you do it. I'm like, what? That's the way? What, you hop in your fucking DeLorean and go back 9 years and start therapy? Because you recognize that what you're doing is fucking shitty. Like, there's no path back for Bill Peters. I'm sorry. The thing that people have to realize about these situations is that they're business decisions. Like, Cherry was a business decision. It wasn't a moral decision. It was a business decision. Bill Peters is at the end of the day, if you want to hire him, it's a business decision. You have to go to your consumer base and go to these demographics that you're chasing and say, oh, hey, look, I know we hired this racist, but, like, they're never going to fucking do that. He's done. He's cooked. He's never going to work in the NHL again.
The path back for Bill Peters probably, if there is one, involves about 10 years in the minors and the KHL and all this other stuff. And then maybe, because then you don't need the DeLorean because you're 10 years into the future, but it's, yeah, the short term, you're right, of course.
I just think for Crawford, it's a lot easier because you could be like, I've been working on myself versus someone like Bill Peters who can't even apologize to the guy he offended.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, and there's, I've said since the beginning, there's a path back for Babcock. He's the easy one.
Well, you know, I used to coach a certain way. Those tactics aren't, appropriate today. Learn my lesson. Blah, 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 blah.
I mean, like, he's going to be fucking coaching by next week. Like, it's he's the easiest one.
Yep. No, it's so.
Yeah, I think that's pretty obvious. Yeah.
I don't know.
Babcock's just going to collect his check for a while and call it good.
Peters is cooked, though.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. See you later.
If you had your choice between Mike Babcock, Pete DeBoer, and Paul Maurice as the first head coach of the Seattle, hopefully, Sasquatch, who would you hire?
Probably Babcock. It's going to be a mostly veteran roster, and that's who he does well with.
I'd go Paul Maurice partly because you're a new market, and I want the guy who's kind of smooth and hilarious and interesting, and not the guy who's sour and cranky and
that's true,
barking at everyone all the time, which isn't a great reason to make a hockey decision. But if plus if you're Ron Francis, you know the guy, you have the history. So
that's a really good point. The temperament thing, like. Like, Gallant was just sort of a dude, you know? Mm-hmm. He kind of was part of the whole misfit thing was the way that he got. And having someone who's as wry as Maurice, as, like, the voice of your team to start off, I kind of like that. It's a really good point. I never really thought of it that way. Which is why you don't hire DeBoer. Like, he's a great coach, but he's not exactly, like, the greatest salesman in the world. He's kind of standoffish a little bit. I dig that idea. So anyways, Taylor Hall, like we said, very exciting. I'm sure those 2 hours he spent meeting all of the Coyotes fans was probably time well spent for Taylor Hall. I'm sorry.
And literally all the Coyotes fans.
I don't want to shit on Arizona. They always get shit on. I know. I'm sorry. It's a very exciting time for the Coyotes and, fill the building. That's all I'm saying. And if you're going to fill the building, there's no better way to do it than with SeatGeek.
There it is.
Not really.
It's a B-, right?
Ooh. Boy, lots of generous grades going around today, I feel like.
What's the Rotten Tomatoes score for that transition?
It's like a 68, Greg. Come on.
That's certified fresh right there.
Sure. D is 58 passing. 58
isn't, apparently. The Rise of Skywalker reviews came out. And I was looking at the tomato score, and it's climbing. Like, it's getting better. And then the ones for Cats came out, and I'm like, oh, no, that's never climbing.
Nope.
Oh, the tomato rating for Cats is going to be pretty low. I'm definitely seeing Cats, by the way, in the next few days, because my wife is a huge fan of the musical. Much to my chagrin. With millions of live event tickets, from sports and live music to comedy and probably Cats, SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. Did you know that Cats has been on whatever Tokyo's Broadway is since 1983, and they just had their 10,000th show of Cats?
Jesus.
In Japan.
Wow.
Crazy.
It even rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10 and displays them on an interactive seat map. Green dots mean good deals. Red dots are overpriced. I read a review for Cats that said that at least one of the special effects wasn't completed. And I'm very curious what that means.
Amazing. Like,
is there someone dancing in a green bodysuit and they just didn't do the CGI, Cat CGI? Is there like an actual scene that says, you know, TK to come?
Apparently.
I don't know.
Apparently they were like doing the final edit 2 hours before the premiere.
Yeah. Yeah, I read that. Yeah, before the premiere, the Tom Hooper, the director, literally was said, we just finished doing this.
He said he'd been up for like 36 straight hours. Amazing. I fucking love it, dude.
That way you can stop searching for the perfect seat and start enjoying it. And every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop on SeatGeek with confidence. Rebel Wilson plays Jenny Anydots, and apparently her role in the movie is to stand in the back of the frame and make cat puns. Like, hey, look what the cat dragged in. Like, that's her whole gig.
Sounds cool. Great.
There's no dialogue in Cats, by the way. It's all sung. It's all music. There's no, like, that. Like the musical is just, there's no story.
Awesome. I can't wait to see this movie.
Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop on SeatGeek with confidence. No wonder SeatGeek has over 50,000 five-star reviews, or 50,000 more five-star reviews than Cats. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone. It's the easiest way that I use to find tickets. I'm definitely going to use some to find tickets to a couple Golden State Warriors games because I want to see the new arena, and they're abjectly terrible, so I assume that tickets will be available.
$10.
Yeah, they'll pay me. SeatGeek will even give you $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you need to do is use their promo code. The promo code you're looking for is SOUP. S-O-U-P. That spells SOUP. For $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. That's promo codes. Sean, do you know the plot of Cats? Are you aware of it?
You know what? I'm aware of Cats. I never saw it, but my sister was like a big musical fan growing up, so I've heard the music. Like,
sure,
on the
she was.
But I don't know the story, except that when the movie started coming out, I saw some summaries of the story, and it sounds completely insane. Like, I didn't realize it was that level of crazy.
There is no story, per se. As Ruby will point out, Cats is a series of introductions of different kinds of cats and different, like, it's just a series of songs where you meet new cats, okay, basically. But the thrust of the movie is they're having a giant celebration called the Jellicle Ball. And at the Jellicle Ball, they choose one cat to ascend, basically.
To die.
Yeah. It's a suicide cult musical.
That's my understanding.
Yeah, and they pick, like, the oldest cat to die and then get reincarnated, I guess, as a kitten. But I'll never forget my experience finally seeing Cats as an adult, where Ruby took me to see it in its latest revival in Manhattan. And and at the end, the realization that was the story. And it was, like, 2 hours of fun, you know, adults in cat suits licking their paws and going into the audience, crawling around. And at the end of the day, it's a movie about a suicide cult. It was both the most pleasing and shocking feeling I've ever had at the same time.
As far as I know, the one positive review on Rotten Tomatoes when I looked last night was
by a cat.
No, it was from a guy from the Arizona Republic, and the poll quote was, "I didn't hate it." That was the poll quote.
All right.
The positive review.
Okay.
The reviews are, there's a certain pylon effect, which we could talk about in a second about, like,
some of these reviews are trying a little too hard at this point.
You think so?
Yeah.
Because some of the reviews are like,
well, I haven't seen the movie. I feel like maybe they're not trying too hard based on A, the subject matter, and B,
this
Les Mis version this director put out, whatever, 6 or 7 years ago.
This was a smattering of the reviews. These are actual poll quotes from the reviews. Boston Globe: "My eyes are burning. Oh God, my eyes." Collider: "Can you make a movie so bad that the Academy takes back your best director Oscar, asking for Tom Hooper?" Hollywood Reporter: "Catastrophic." LA Times: "Cats is both a horror and an endurance test." Variety: "9 may not be enough lives for some of the stars to live down their involvement in this poorly conceived and executed adaptation." And Vulture: "To assess Cats as good or bad feels like the entirely wrong axis on which to see it. It is, with all affection, a monstrosity."
Yeah, I can't wait. This is going to be awesome. Gonna fucking rule to see this movie.
That's promo code SOUP for $10 off your first purchase. SeatGeek, they have the tickets.
Oh yeah, I guess we didn't finish that. Oh, yeah. Oops. Oh well.
Hey, listen, I'm on it. You know, I don't get the accolades that you get when you do the fucking ad reads, but I try my best. I'm a try hard to that end. Douglas Brown, you wrote a very interesting piece, well received by the Athletic Commentariat. as per usual. I'm sure a few people mentioned outright that this is why they subscribe to The Athletic. The 10 players that no NHL fan can hate, except for all the ones that do.
So this is my...
Ryan, have you seen this list?
I have. I gave him a smiley guy.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thank you. That's fantastic.
Those do help. Now, always click the smiley guy.
What was your motivation here? What was your motivation in doing this list? Was it to put a little positivity into the world?
Sure. Let's say that. This is something that I've done a few times over the every few years. I like to kind of do a roundup because I find, as hockey fans, and I'm certainly guilty of this, we tend to focus on the negative, and you know, it's the holidays. Let's just talk about the players. Yeah, not the present company excluded, of course. Let's focus on the positive and, you know, goodwill and all that sort of stuff. And so I made a list of the 10 players that nobody seems to be able to hate. And then I also listed all the reasons why some people do hate them and why maybe you could hate them too.
Hmm. I don't want to give away like the whole, you know, cow here, but
that's
a few tastes of milk. Marc-Andre Fleury, I think I think if you had done this list 5 years ago,
agreed. Yeah,
I'm not quite sure if he's on it, but I think that the Vegas experience has made him one of the single most.
Yeah, the one that is the most. There's nobody on this list that I'm going to get 100% buy-in from everyone on, but that's as close as it comes. Like he left one team, but he left in pretty much the best pot. I mean, I think the fans of the Penguins like Marc-Andre Fleury now more than they did when he played there.
And probably more than Vegas fans like him.
Maybe, yeah. Vegas fans love the guy, though. And even like the fans of other teams, and this is somewhat maybe a goalie thing. Like, are there Sharks fans who hate Marc-Andre Fleury? Like, maybe. But, it's a pretty... It's a pretty tough one to hate. The like I think I said in the article, the only people I can think of that could hate him would be Canadian fans that are still bitter over the World Juniors like 20 years ago that he screwed up, and then Hall of Fame sticklers when they realize he's getting in on the first ballot, and maybe they don't feel good about that. Other than that,
very good. Patrick Marleau made this list.
Yeah, and
I feel like he's a good choice because he's sort of, I mean, he's like innocuous, right? Like,
yeah, I don't think about him anymore.
Yeah, and in fact, he was one of the guys that I almost didn't put on the list just because I'm not sure that he's as really qualifies as a star, which is what I was going for here. Even though I said players, and I've now got people in the comments like suggesting like obscure fourth liners off their team. They're like, nobody hates, you know. Nobody hates Blake Coleman, and you're like, okay, sure. But
I'm glad you put that caveat in there because there was one name that I didn't see, and maybe he doesn't qualify as a star.
Well, Greg, what you should do is go into the comments and just type that person's name with a question mark, and then just that's it. That'd be your full.
Excellent, because I did a search, and Eric A., a very real person, already did it for me. Hurdle question mark? That was the guy that I would say.
Yeah,
like Thomas Hurdle.
I also tried to do one player per team. I didn't want to load it. So Marleau kind of got the Sharks.
The Sharks thing.
I consider Joe Thornton, but I've learned my lesson in the past that Blues fans are not having any sort of "we all love Joe Thornton" moment. I went with Marleau, and mainly because I do think he's a likable guy. He's, you know, he's well liked in Toronto and all of that. And also because I like to occasionally mention that next year he's going to break Gordie Howe's all time games played record, because that seems to bother people and they don't realize it's about to happen. I'm looking forward to the awkwardness when that turns into a thing.
Hurdle's the only guy that I think I would have lobbied for that's not on the list. But one guy that you had here who I think is interesting is Patrice Bergeron. That's a really good pick. That's like an unimpeachably, like, he's sort of like Sid without Flyers fans.
Yeah.
he's just like a perfect player that everybody respects. And the only thing that you don't maybe like about him is that he, like you said, that he skates with Marchand.
Yeah, that's it. Which maybe even helps him, because it's like the yin to the yang sort of thing, where you're like, you know, every now and then you're like, do I not like this guy? And then you're like, oh no, look at that guy. No, I really don't like that guy. So mm-hmm. everyone else around him seems better. The thing with Bergeron, like I said in the piece, is I feel like for a long time there was this sort of three-headed, like Bergeron, Jonathan Toews, Anze Kopitar thing, where it was like you had to like one of those guys to show that you were the sort of fan who could appreciate two-way players and 200-foot hockey and all of this. And it just feels like in the last couple of years, Bergeron's kind of broken off and claimed that throne all on his own, where he's like, even if you don't like him, you have to say you do to show your bona fides as like a fan who's not just looking for 100-point seasons and that sort of thing. And I think he's kind of broken away, and Mark Stone is coming for that throne but isn't there yet. So for now, right. at least, like Bergeron is the guy that you have to say that you know, even if you don't love the guy, you have to say that you respect him to prove that you are capable of appreciating that type of hockey, which you should be, because he's a
right.
amazingly good player.
Right. One name that I think is interesting just because of how perceptions have changed is Lundqvist. I can remember a few years ago when Lundqvist, there were Lundqvist detractors because they thought he was overrated, and B, he was sort of the poster child for shitty equipment and and making saves with your big pads you shouldn't be making. And now I think that because the Rangers have been so bad and because he's still there, that there's like a groundswell of sympathy for, well, fuck, he never won the thing.
Yeah.
And that sucks because he's great.
The thing with him is like you go down the list of like the dude is he's like a star athlete in New York, a model, a rock star. He mm-hmm. posts Instagram with his dogs. He, like, I think he has a restaurant. It almost gets to the point where you're like, it's too much, and you would expect the backlash to kick in and be like, screw it. Like the Derek Jeter level of like, screw this guy. Like, I've had enough. Tom Brady, same sort of deal. Except he hasn't won. So mm-hmm. that's like what adds this sort of urgency to the end of his career, and the fact that he's come so close and clearly wants it so badly, like that kind of lets you off the hook to that you can be behind this guy, even though he's the sort of guy that if you met him in real life, you'd walk away 5 minutes later going, screw that guy. He makes me feel bad about myself.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think a lot of it is, you know, throughout the list, I think the main theme is old guys who haven't really won anything.
Some of it is, yeah.
If you're 36 and you haven't won a cup or maybe too many major awards or anything like that, everybody just kind of goes, yeah, he's pretty cool. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. It definitely helps. Because as soon as people start winning and assuming they're not on your team, like that's when a little bit of that bitterness kind of starts kicking in. And there's sure. like I say, I've done this over the years. I think the last one I did was maybe 3 years ago. And I had Toews on that list. Whereas now I feel like a few years later, even though the Blackhawks aren't good anymore, there's enough of the backlash has kicked in, like between them always being on TV and the outdoor games and the top 100 debacle. It's sort of like, I feel like people are kind of like, that's enough with Chicago. Like he's not, they just kind of roll their eyes and he's not quite there yet, but he's like into that Crosby zone where people don't like, even though they, you know, they come up with reasons why they don't like somebody, mm-hmm. but really it's because he's super good and he keeps kicking your teams behind and that's it. But you can't say that. So you come up with other reasons to tell yourself.
Right. And people think he's overrated and yada, yada, yada. Is Phil Kessel, internet lovable yes. or real life lovable?
What is there a difference? I thought it was the same. Yeah. I put Phil Kessel on the list, and I acknowledged in the piece that this was maybe me projecting a little bit, but I feel like we're at the point where, at least as fans, like get on board. Like I get he's kind of goofy and awkward. And there was a time where he didn't seem to know how to handle that, but he's either now like learned how to lean into it a little bit, or maybe just the people around him have learned how to manage it a bit better that, I don't know. I have a lot of fun with the Phil Kessel experience. Mm-hmm. And, I understand, you know, when I was listing, like here's who maybe doesn't like him. It was kind of like, well, all his ex-coaches and most of his ex-GMs and many of his teammates and all the media who's ever covered him. And like, it's, you know, but if you're just a fan sitting at home watching the guy, I mean, he's fun as hell to watch. And I mean, he ate hot dogs out of the Stanley Cup. Like, what do you want? Like, yeah, he either thought of doing that or somebody told him to do it and he was like, sure, whatever. I think
that's another one is just like guys who catch perhaps an undue amount of shit from the media, you know?
Yeah. The backlash to the backlash is...
That's correct, yeah.
The strong one.
I know who likes him most. His hot dog vendor. I'm Steve Simmons, TSN.
I agree with your evaluation of Taves, which was making me wonder how people will feel about his placement on my list that dropped today.
Yes.
The top 100 players of the decade. A labor of love, my friends, this list. In true former
Speaking
blog
of lists
fashion,
that will generate
I spent way too much time on this fucking thing. I tried my best to get it right, and I think I did, but like, to put it in perspective on how much I bit off more than I could chew, it's like stuffing an entire large pizza in your mouth. Is kind of what this list was for the last week and a half.
And I just from experience, I know this is the sort of list that like. It seems like a good idea, and you sit down to write it, and you get, like, the top five, and you're like, this is good, and next thing you know, it's 3 days later, and you're, like, on going back and forth between spot 46 and 47, and you haven't eaten in 2 days, and you're just like, what happened? Where did my family go?
I'll pull back the curtain, man. Like, I did this entire list. I had the whole thing I thought locked and loaded, and then I realized that I didn't have Joe Thornton on it. Yeah. I'm like, oh, shit,
that's always
there.
Then you realize, like... Or you have like the 4 a.m, like, wait a second, did I not put the, oh God.
No, the 4 a.m one was straight I went up back and bed, looked at it. Yeah. I had Ben Bishop twice. So I'm like, fuck.
All right. See, that's just, you're just trolling Ryan there. That's.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Top 15, Jonathan Taves. I think for all the backlash about him being overrated and whatever, you can't deny the numbers are solid, great two-way player. Selke winner, fifth in the decade in points per game average in the playoffs and a Conn Smythe. Like, legitimately one of the best players of the decade, even not as good as people make him out to be. 14, Kucherov. Just like next level offensive player when he's not being scratched.
And we should mention, like, it is tough when you do these lists. Like, how do you deal with guys who kind of came in halfway through the decade or established themselves
halfway through in a second.
Yeah, which there are bigger ones there, but I thought you handled that pretty well where it was...
The part of the criteria was like, we value stretches of years together. You know, that plays well. It's a lot of reliance on GAR and WAR to determine the goodness of players. I did that for Ryan's sake, so he wouldn't yell at me. And... yeah, there's ways to figure it out. Like, I just don't think that an all-decade list should just be guys that played the whole decade. Like,
it definitely should. Yeah, I mean, I caught some shit for putting Connor McDavid as the 13th forward on my all-decade lineup. And people were furious. Like, right. People were like, what the fuck? Why not Claude Giroux? Why not this guy? You know, whatever it was.
Why not Claude Giroux?
Yeah, it was. Well, it was Claude Giroux.
Claude Giroux is on my list. He's 18th. Like, I think that's an appropriate place to put him.
I think just outside the best. I mean, like, you know, how many major awards was he even really considered for? You know,
the big thing for me was like I had three guys that were kind of in the same genre as Patrice Bergeron, and it was Kopitar, Taves, and Giroux. Mm-hmm. Okay,
yeah, that's the trio. Those guys are going to be forever.
And I think that the proper order is I have Kopitar 13th, Taves 15th, and Drew 18th. Like, I think Kopitar is the best of those three, in my opinion.
You are correct, yes.
Okay. So he's 13th. Yeah. 12th is Hedman.
Works for me.
Here's where things get fun. The 11th best player of the decade is Pavel Datsyuk.
Yeah, it's hard to... I mean, like, it's... Mm-hmm. He is a guy like Jonathan Taves where he... really only had like one or two seasons where he scored a shitload. But fuck, man, right. He was so good at everything else that it didn't matter. And we kind of forget that already, I think. That like I think he was, you know, a little bit overrated, like, oh, he's such an offensive wizard and stuff like that. It's like, no, he's just like insanely good at hockey. Like he was good in the shootout or whatever, but you know,
people tend to be amazed when they realize that he didn't have 1,000 points.
Like, he didn't even come particularly close. Like, he needed like another season and a half, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So and he is also one of those guys where, like, I don't want to turn into one of those, like, well, 200 hockey men, but players love that guy. Like, players, you know, because there's always guys where it's like some third liner with terrible numbers, and they're like, no, if you played the game, you would understand. But the players perfect example, drool over Pavel Datsyuk.
Yeah, they the perfect example that of that is one time I don't remember because this is like 1996 or 97 or whatever. But there was a time when they asked who's the hardest guy to play against in the league, and Jaromir Jagr said Hal Gill. And I think that comment alone made Hal Gill like $14 million fucking dollars in his career. Yep. But that's a real thing that, you know, inexplicably happened. So
right. Mm-hmm. That's why I think the story of Daniel Day-Lewis calling up Adam Sandler to tell him how much he appreciated his performance in Uncut Gems is going to get Sandler an Oscar nomination.
Fuck, I can't wait to see that movie. Like, he got the
rub. Datsyuk's 11th. Duncan Keith, 10th. I wanted to drop Keith lower than Hedman, but everybody that I talked to for this ranking was like, that's nuts. Like, his early decade seasons were fucking like amongst incredible. Some of the best.
Yeah.
So I'll bite my lip and put him 10th. 9 is Patrick Kane. 8 is Stamkos, second best goal scorer of the decade. 7th is Bergeron. 6th is Malkin. Someone on Reddit said that I should have left Malkin off the list as a joke.
Should have left Taves off the list as a joke if you're doing it that way.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah. If I was still at Puck Daddy, I might have attempted that and then, like, added him later just to kind of troll people for a few hours. 5 is Lundqvist. Lundqvist is the best goalie of the decade. Yep. His numbers are fantastic. But only won the Vezina once and was a finalist twice. Kind of. But that's, like, the GMs and their whatever their fucking hang-ups are about Lundqvist, which I'll never understand. 4, Erik Karlsson.
Yeah, that it felt a little high to me, but I don't.
Yeah, you think so? Why is that?
I don't know. I don't know if the separation between him and the other defensemen is as wide, and especially as, like, you made a reference in your write up on him, which I agree with completely, which is that his reputation as like a one way offensive guy is overstated. But also, we've kind of. Today, well, not even today, he hasn't been great lately, but the like from 2015 on, he was actually a pretty good defensive defenseman, and as well as being an all-world offensive defenseman. But I feel like it took people long enough to realize that we've sort of now retroactively gone back and changed it so that he was always that. And in his first few years, he actually was a pretty bad defensive defenseman. Like, he was
the guy that
first Norris year
was
dicey.
Yeah. He used his speed to overcome a lot of that. Like he would make mistakes and then he would be like exponentially faster than everybody else on the ice. And so it would look better than it was.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where I'm doing that thing that I hate when people do to my rankings, where I'm like looking at Erik Karlsson at 4 and going, that doesn't feel right. But it's like, okay, so who do you move up? Where do you put him? And I'm not sure. He just doesn't feel like a number 4 to me. And yet, like, I was looking at, you know, my first thought was Malkin should be higher, but Malkin, you know, he had the one Hart trophy, but his
injuries,
you know, his really elite years, most of them were before the decade. So I don't know. It's one of those things where it feels high, but I'm not sure you're wrong.
All right. Here's where things get dicey. Number 3 is Ovechkin. Number 2 is McDavid. And number 1 is obviously Sid. And I'm taking a lot of heat from Ovechkin Nation, understandably. he was
I don't think it's that understandable. I think he's a bit of an overrated player. I mean, like, he does one thing. Like, if we want to say one-dimensional
player. But the one thing
player,
he does is,
well, yeah, he,
like, better than anybody.
He does, no, like, I know, and, better than NHL maybe history. Anyone in history.
No, and I, it's, yeah.
like,
I agree with
and
that.
And it's one of the most important. It's not like he's the best shot blocker or, like, best face-off
right, but
guy.
Like,
he is.
But, like, if we're gonna if we're gonna ding Erik Karlsson for spending a good chunk of the decade not being a good 200-foot player or whatever. Yeah. Alex Ovechkin's really only like an 8-foot player, and it's the 8 feet around the top of the left circle. But man, he's fucking great there. So I like I get it, but
But at the same time, and somebody I think in the comment section on mine made this point, and it's been made many times before. When you look at Ovechkin's game, if he was, and I hate to do this because I people make this point in various ways all the time, and I think it's usually wrong, but if Alexander Ovechkin was Canadian, we would be talking about him as one of the great power forwards of all time. He would be like
yes,
right
absolutely.
Up there with Cam Neely and
it's,
those guys.
It's okay
like,
to say that because you're speaking the truth.
Yeah. And it's okay because I'm Canadian, so it's okay. I can say it. Yeah, if he was like some dude from Saskatoon running over people like that, like he does and playing the physical style, then that would be, you know, we wouldn't consider him one dimensional because we'd be, it would be like Cam Neely. Cam Neely only scored goals, but he also trucked guys. And so, you know, Cam Neely escaped that label. And it, but the fact that it was a Russian guy doing it, I feel like we still don't really know what to do with it. I would have put Ovechkin ahead of McDavid, just based on how I would weigh an entire decade versus half of one. But I don't know. It's
Ovechkin,
that's where you get into such
11th
a gray area
among that. Forwards in WAR over the decade, the full decade, behind guys like Kopitar, Malkin, Sagan, Tavares, Taves, Benn, Marchand,
yeah.
Kane,
I mean,
Crosby.
I know those stats are. I appreciate the work that's been done on them, but if someone's saying Jamie Benn was a better winger this decade than Alexander Ovechkin, then I think. We've got some more work to do on.
The argument would be that he is not like a black hole defensively. And Ovechkin, you know, I can't imagine. Let's see. How many worse offensive players? Vanek, Kessel, and Kane are the only worse offense or defensive players at even strength over the last decade.
Yeah.
By that metric.
And that's fair. I don't think. And you got to measure that sort of stuff at even strength, but we're also talking about one of the greatest power play guys of all time.
So let's look at his contributions to power play offense, second only to Nicky Backstrom, who I think got to piggyback a little bit.
Oh, and also, I forgot that. I was going to say this earlier. Nick Backstrom would have been an interesting one for your list, Sean.
Yep.
Who hates Nicky Backstrom? Nicky Bax.
Nope. He definitely would have been. Again, I wanted to go one player a team, and I picked Ovechkin. And again, that was partly me lobbying because I feel like it's not something that everyone's on board with. And I kind of wanted to push for it. Although I got to say, I found it funny that the most pushback I got on Ovechkin was from Hurricanes fans who are still mad about the Svechnikov fight. Which I get, but I said this in the comments. I'm like, look, if Carolina Hurricanes fans, you got to pick a lane. Like, you can't be the fun-loving, like, silly celebrations, and we play weird music after we win, and we have funny hair, and we make T-shirts, and we're going to single-handedly take down the old guard of Brian Burke and Don Cherry. But then when your favorite player loses a fight, suddenly you're like, we have a code that must be respected. And you can't, like, you can't do that, man. When like one of the most entertaining players of his generation wins a fight against a guy on your team, you can't suddenly go off and sulk because he's not respecting the code when you're the like slam dunk of basketball after we win team. Like, you gotta kind of one or the other here.
I agree with that, but I also think that you're underestimating the ancillary Southeast Division angst that occurs when it comes to Ovechkin.
Yeah.
They got some history, them and the Hurricanes.
Sure.
that's the most Canadian thing you've ever done in this show, is the abject disrespect for the history of the Southeast Division.
Hey, what do you think? The Winnipeg Jets are Southeast alumni. Don't go telling me
they
that as a Canadian, I don't respect
year, right?
the Southeast.
That was like their first season within the Southeast.
Yep.
This is a great league.
Yeah, so top 100 players of the decade, and down goes Brown's list of the most likable players. Two mandatory pieces of reading for you.
Can I say my thing that everybody yelled at me about? Someone asked for your Mount Rushmore of WWE, and I said, it's pretty definitively Hogan, Austin, Rock, Cena. And people are like, what about Shawn Michaels? What about the Macho Man, Randy Savage? And it's like, come on, man.
That's not worth yelling about. I think you could make a case for some other guys, but the idea that, for better or for worse.
I think the only issue, I've thought about this, the Mount Rushmore thing before. The only problem I have, and the only issue that you have to resolve when it comes to a WWE, WWF Mount Rushmore, is whether or not Vince is on it. Like, if you're just saying wrestlers, then it becomes a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. If you're saying the company, Vince has to be on it. Hogan has to be on it. Austin has to be on it. And then you have another spot.
Triple H then, right? Like, just in terms of everything he did.
I've always gone in a different direction here. I've always said that if you're going to have Vince on the mountain, which I think you do, it would be Vince, Hogan, Austin, Undertaker. Because I think with the Undertaker, you have not only one of the best performers through multiple decades, but you have a representation of the fucking gimmicky side of the business. And I feel like if you're doing a Mount Rushmore that represents what the WWF and WWE has been, there needs to be some acknowledgement of the fucking wrestling garbage truck guy and the voodoo guy and like all of the
gimmicky. Is Hulk
Hogan gimmicky...
not that?
No. Oh, no. Oh, Hulk Hogan was the golden boy muscle steroid guy. I'm talking about like the Undertaker – once crucified somebody above the ring. Like, fucking, like, the goofy...
Yeah, it was Stone Cold Steve Austin.
He used to walk around with an urn. He had a Gomez Adams as a manager. Like, all this... Like, you need some representation of that side of the business on the mountain. And you don't get that with Cena or The Rock. And you do get that with The Undertaker. That's always been my
argument. I think you kind of get that with Cena. Dr. Thugonomics and all that shit.
But that's... But not that, not the cartoony side, not like the wrestling, like earthquake and shit. Like you need that kind of thing on the mountain, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well,
the cartooner side of things. What's your Rushmore, Sean?
Geez, I don't know. I mean, Hogan obviously, Austin obviously. You want to put The Rock on there, even though you're doubling up on the same era. I mean, I'm Canadian, so I'm going to try to like chisel Bret Hart on there, whether
I was wondering why your list wasn't Bret Hart, Owen Hart,
Ryan
Pillman,
four of the five Hart Foundation members. Yeah, Canadian Mount Rushmore has got five people on it. It's a conversion rate thing. I don't know. I think you guys have got the right main guys into the mix, and then you probably do have to do Cena, even if it's just to represent the era where everything just got so boring and. Unwatchable.
Sean Starr from TSN 690 was the guy who started this, and his list was Hogan, Undertaker, Rock, and Stone Cold. I'm with you, Ryan, that like it's hard for me to not acknowledge the post-Attitude Era that Cena clearly was the face for.
Cena has as many titles as Ric Flair. That's the end of the fucking argument. Like, he is, for better or worse, the most important wrestler of the post 2000 WWF /E.
Sure. And in a way you could even have him on that list instead of The Rock to say that he's a representation of the crossover stardom.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, The Rock is by like the biggest actor in the world. Like not just like the biggest actor to be a wrestler, like to have started as a wrestler. He is the biggest actor in the world. So you like he is everything that, you know, like Hulk Hogan launched the industry into what it became. Obviously, like there's no WWF without Hulk Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
But The Rock t- took what Hulk Hogan did as a crossover star, and he was like, oh, you're going to be like whatever, fucking – what was it? Mr. Mom, or was he
– excuse me. Mr. Nanny, Mr. Nanny, Santa with Muscles, Suburban Commando, and on television, Thunder in Paradise, sir.
Thunder in Paradise was the other one I was trying to pull besides Mr. Nanny or whatever. But The Rock was like, I'm going to do all that but also be in like six of the biggest or the highest grossing movies of the late 2010s.
Yeah.
And just he'll do it forever now. Like he's going to be doing it till he's 70. So he's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I think the key for The Rock was that he did some roles that didn't require him to do any wrestling moves. Like, it was always depressing when you saw, like, a wrestler try to do a real movie, and at some point there's a suplex.
Oh, yeah. Well, in Hobbs and Shaw, Roman Reigns spears somebody and does the Superman punch, and it's like, fuck you. Get lost. Get out of this movie.
Yeah, exactly. All right. I think we're all in the neighborhood there.
Yeah.
But I would put Vince on the mountain. I think that's a real key. All right. It's time for a little bit of first off, Ilya Kovalchuk. Anything to say about that?
Yeah, I mean,
bad idea at the time. Worst idea given how it worked out.
Yep.
I'm fascinated to see where he goes and you know, if he goes and takes some minimum deal somewhere to play for like a Boston or whoever. You know, stranger things have happened, but at 6.5 million on 35 plus.
I had someone reach out to me and assure me that he wouldn't be a top 13 forward in St. Petersburg at this point. So,
wow.
Yeah. Yep.
Like Florida? Ooh, or
I think SKA St. Petersburg, the team he came.
Oh, okay.
Because that's what I said it on Twitter, like, you know, I give him a shot, and if he has two bad games, I send his ass back to St. Petersburg. And people were like, you know, dial back the racism. And it's like, well, I mean, that's just the team he played for. I don't think he's even from St. Petersburg in Russia. I think he's from a different city entirely.
You pulled the Paul Bissonnette back to the Soviet?
I guess so.
Twitter?
Yeah. I wish he was Soviet. Then we'd have really something to talk about.
You'd be all about it.
Yeah. But nope.
Ryan's WWE Mountain is Nikolai Volkov, Rusev. So, yeah, I think he's cooked.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Which is a shame. He waited too long. Like, if he had come back, like,
3 years before that, yeah.
Yeah, 3 years before that, he would have been fine. But, I mean, I understand why he didn't. It's just a bummer to see.
One of the greats.
Yeah, he was on my list.
He's fucking awesome.
Way high, though. He was very high, though.
He left the league for like 6 years, so I get it, but
he was 88th.
Yeah.
Sandwiched between Mikko Koivu and Andre Vasilevsky.
He should have been fucking higher than Mikko Koivu.
He was higher than Mikko Koivu.
Okay,
I
didn't know if you had Vasilevsky
higher than Mikko Koivu.
He should have been significantly higher than Mikko Koivu.
We didn't address the shitposting on my list. Here's my bottom three. My bottom three were number 100, Alexander Semin.
Yeah, that's insane, but okay.
Number 99, Tori Krug.
Reasonable.
And number 98, Jaromir Jagr.
Should have been higher, I would say, but there's okay. Another guy who spent, the first 3 years of the decade not in the NHL, and then the last two not in the NHL, so I get that too. But yeah.
He was great.
He was fucking
But he showed
really
his
good.
Age at the end. Boy, did he. All right, so before we head out, this is the last episode we're doing before Christmas. And Merry Christmas to everybody. I say Merry Christmas knowing that there is a war on Christmas, Ryan. And I proudly say it in defiance of that war on Christmas.
Yeah, well, thanks to President Trump, we can say Merry Christmas again. It is legal for us. To come mm-hmm. out of the Sharia law under Barack Hussein Obama, and now we can say Merry Christmas again, thankfully.
Has the Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays thing been a thing in Canada, where there's been a sea change in how many people say, like, Merry Christmas versus Happy Holidays?
Every dumb thing that you guys do down there, makes its way here first as us laughing at it and then as our own dumb people trying to copy it. So,
right.
No, yeah. It's not yeah. a thing that people are legitimately mad about, but people have realized that pretending to be mad about it is good business. So, yes, it is.
Up there, it's Happy Holidays, and that's the second week in a row. I made that fucking joke, and it's still working. So,
you can, I mean, it's Advent, so you can continue to make it.
That's right.
Overrated, underrated, favorite, least favorite Christmas shit is the list for this week. And this could be anything. This could be literally anything that has to do with Christmas or the holiday season, if you want. All of it. Overrated, underrated, favorite, least favorite Christmas shit. Overrated, of course, is simply having a wonderful Christmas time. Fucking terrible song.
Everybody agrees it's a terrible song, though. No, there's nobody who's like, I unironically think this is one of Paul McCartney's great. Everybody agrees that it's like a cynical cash grab and it's bad. The actual overrated thing is, of course, eggnog.
Oh, that's good. I retract. I retract, Your Honor. It's eggnog.
That is up there. Boy, I was actually thinking of saying eggnog.
And like, literally, you guys know, like, you could put booze in anything. I'm going to fucking like it. Except eggnog. Like, even as a delivery system for booze, I hate eggnog. I hate it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind eggnog, but I'm alone in my house on that, so we don't even bother with it. And it's fine. It's we're not missing it at all, so...
I retract eggnog. Overrated is anybody in 2019 that's still doing the Die Hard as a Christmas movie bit.
Yes.
Fuck that.
Yeah. Thank you for that because.
Thank you. I'm here for you. What's your overrated?
I put me down for eggnog. Sure.
Okay. Underrated. I discovered this past weekend in Disneyland. We took a little trip to Anaheim. Holiday churros. Had that for the first
what
time.
What makes it different from a standard issue churro that you get in, say, August?
Let me tell you, Ryan. Flavors like peppermint, horchata, all sort of like holiday accoutrement on these churros. And I discovered like this Christmas subculture that goes to Disneyland. They wear footy pajamas. They walk around. And they go from churro stand to churro stand sampling the holiday churros. So I am now a holiday churro guy, underrated part of Christmas because not a lot of people know about it.
Yeah, no, that sounds pretty fucking good, actually. I got to be honest. Underrated, I'm going to say, you know, I think people really think it's good, but they really, I think, don't give it the – this is a modern – Christmas classic. The Charlie Brown Christmas soundtrack is perfect.
It's a banger.
It's so fucking good. I just bought it on vinyl the other day. I saw it in its store and I was like, yeah, I have to buy this.
Wow.
You buying the Charlie Brown Christmas soundtrack on vinyl is the most on-brand thing.
It's cool as hell. Sorry, dude.
It really is. It really is.
Wow. My underrated thing is other people's Christmas lights. I think they look really cool, and I enjoy driving around with my family and looking at them. And as long as other people have put them up and it's not my house, because I hate doing it for my house, and it's a pain in the ass. But I appreciate effort to do it at your place so I can drive by and look at it.
Sidebar, do you like the overly egregious, like, local news station comes and films the house level of lights?
Yep, that can be fun. There's actually a street up here in Ottawa that one of our friends grew up on where every single house does that, and it's insanity. There's like a gridlock traffic jam on the street. And it's like a little residential street. And I always think, like, the person I feel bad for is like the dude who buys a house there in May and doesn't know that it's like insane varsity level competition for Christmas lights. So, yeah, I'm all in. I want you to have like a radio station that I can tune into when I pull up I want all of it, and then I want to drive back to my house. It's got like one strand of lights along the garage because I left it until it was minus 20, and I was like, screw this. Yeah, that's what I'm looking for.
Favorite Christmas shit. This is going to sound real corny, but like it's Christmas, so like that's allowed. I love how time stops for like at least 15 hours. And I still remember Christmas in New York where you'd walk out of your apartment on Christmas morning, maybe to go get like bagels or whatever. And it's just, it's a ghost town. It's just empty. And everybody just kind of does nothing for a little bit, even more so than Thanksgiving. Like on Thanksgiving now, the Black Friday shit has crept into Thanksgiving.
Yes.
So like malls are open and shit. Christmas is still maybe the only day of the year where shit just stops for about 10 or 15 hours. And I always love that. Like everything just stops.
Yeah, no, that is really cool. The only way I tell the passage of time on Christmas is when basketball games begin and end. That's it. The rest of the time I'm just like, I don't know what time it is. I guess it might be dark out. It's impossible to say.
That's how I handle Thanksgiving. 1 o'clock game's over, time to eat. 4 o'clock game starts. Let's go back down. Favorite Christmas thing?
You know, I still, like, I'm a 36-year-old man. I still love that fucking Christmas morning feeling, man. Like, it's it's really cool. I don't know how else to put it. I think it's just such a nice, like, you're sitting down with your family, you're having breakfast, you're opening presents. It's great.
It's great.
Yeah, I'm going the presents, man. It's still like I thought I would outgrow this, but I haven't. Cool. I love getting stuff, and I like giving stuff. I like coming up with good stuff to give somebody. I like that feeling of knowing that you've got something good there. I don't even mind doing Christmas shopping as much as I used to, especially these days where you just buy everything online and ship it off. And obviously having kids just kind of makes it extra fun. So
kids independent enough to get you gifts without assistance?
They get we do like a family shopping trip and we split off, and so they pick stuff out. So yes, you are getting something that's a little bit personalized and thought of, which is nice. So
yeah, my kid's not old enough yet. She needs an assist. But that's fine. She doesn't make me anything either. But she is creative. Maybe this will be the year where she makes me. Oh, wait. Nope. That's a Father's Day gift. I take it back. Least favorite. The fact that my kid doesn't make me shit. No. Least favorite. Fake trees. And I know that, like, fake trees are sometimes a necessity. And I know that real trees are egregiously overpriced. So I am not tree shaming here. I'm just saying personal preference, going out, getting a real tree, the smell in your house. Ruby and I try to always chop down a tree at a tree farm every year. It's one of my favorite things about Christmas is the real tree experience, including the haphazard loading it into your car or tying it to the top of your car.
That sounds like a nightmare.
I grew up with a fake tree, and I didn't mind it, but the first time that I got a real tree, I was like, I really been missing out. It's that kind of, and I'm not saying that fake tree, if you have one, you suck or anything, like, it's fine. I just prefer real trees much better.
Yeah, we also grew up with one, and now, you know, like the huge pain in the ass of getting it out of the box, taking, like, putting it back in the box in January or whatever. Like, that sucks. That I have to agree. But for me, I think the least favorite thing is feeling like you did a bad job buying gifts for people, because I always do. And then,
Me too.
You know, everybody's like, oh, this is great. And you're like, yeah, but it could have been better, I feel like.
My is traveling, which I know it always sucks at the best of times, but even worse when you're hauling a bunch of presents and then you have to haul a bunch back. And I hate that feeling of when I'm like visiting, you know, if we're with grandparents for Christmas and seeing like them handing out gifts and being like, you know, this is wonderful, but how am I going to get that back home? Like, can't you get me something smaller so I can cram it into the trunk of the car? And I wish if I could teleport, I'd be happy to be there and be with everyone. But it's just sort of like that. And also that feeling of if you're traveling, like, yeah, we're going to drive down on Christmas Eve day.
On Christmas
and you're just
Eve,
like,
yeah.
What if, yeah, then the weather's bad and you're like, crap, but we got to do it. We got to get there somehow, or, you know, flights are delayed and all that. It's just, I don't love traveling at the best of times, but this is absolutely the worst time to do it.
Indeed. All right. One last thing before we go. I just want to say something about Star Wars reviews. As of right now, none of us have seen it. Ryan, you're seeing it today. I'm seeing it tomorrow morning as we do the podcast. I'm sure. I was worried about this being Star Wars Into Darkness, and it appears that maybe that's what it is.
Yeah,
I'm just kind
really
of frustrating.
Dreading this shit, dude. I'm not happy about any of it.
But I've read so many reviews of the movie. And by the way, I knew the story of the movie beforehand. I was completely spoiled on Reddit. I just can't help myself. And the movie always sounded a little bit specious. But the thing about the reviews that I find really weird is that, like, and I'm not saying this as a Disney guy. Just separate that for a second. The reviews of, like, all the reviews seem to want to touch on the motivations behind the movie as a product versus the actual movie, which I know a lot of people are going to be like, well, it's fucking Star Wars. It is a product. But I don't know how we got here
Here's what I would
culture.
Say is because this one is very explicitly the making of this. You cannot say how this movie got made without understanding that it is a reaction to the reaction to the reaction of The Force Awakens, which I think people mostly were fine with, as they were just like, you know, it's exactly like A New Hope, and that's fine. We don't care too much about that. So then, like, the problems a lot of people online certainly had with The Force Awakens was that, it was a girl protagonist and a black stormtrooper, and isn't that all fucked up? And so Rian Johnson went out and made a movie that I think, has not held up over the past few years, where he's like, oh, you don't like the black stormtrooper and the woman protagonist? Well, now everybody's a woman and a person of color. And how do you like that? And it's like, well, the movie now, like, doesn't make any fucking sense, like, that you had to go out and have everybody break off into all these different teams and, you know.
Well, that's what they did at Empire.
Yes, but not to the extent, like. Like, what did Canto Bite do for the story that Luke going to Dagobah did?
It was a social commentary. That's all it was.
Yeah, which,
I mean,
like,
it's all.
But, like, it didn't need to exist. It didn't further the story at all. And so, like,
it's my least favorite part of the movie.
Yeah, and it's the middle third of it. So that's a real problem. You know, there's technical problems with you know, they're like, oh, we're out of fuel. And it's like, well, fuel has literally never come up in the Star Wars universe before. So that's fucking weird. Well, like,
now you're nitpicking.
Here's what I'm saying, though. So then they were like, oh, fuck you, Rian Johnson. Everybody hated this. We're going to give it back to JJ, who everybody liked his movie well enough. And JJ's like, and fuck you also, Rian Johnson, for, like, saying that Rey's parents. So, like, his movie is a reaction to Rian Johnson reacting to his movie. And, like, you can't therefore, that's why you can't separate these two things out. And I say that as a person who liked both of them initially, and then I just rewatched them this week, and I like them substantially less than I did.
Which one did you like better, though?
Probably The Force Awakens, because it didn't take me two sittings to get through it. But again, it's like, just because I like A New Hope. You know, like, it's just like, oh, remember when all that stuff happened in A New Hope? Well, now it's happening, and there's a little circle robot instead.
I guess my point is that, like, when I used to talk about why Attack of the Clones was the worst Star Wars movie at this time,
not having seen this new one. I've always said it's because it was a reaction by George Lucas to the negative reaction to The Phantom Menace. And it was always like, oh, you didn't like my story? Well, how about I give you all the Star Wars? You know, and then it just became, it was just a shitty movie. And I've said this for decades, but now it seems like that reaction is what has now become film criticism. It's like, you know, what is Justice League? Well, Justice League's reaction to Batman versus Superman. What is the Rise of Skywalker? Well, it's a reaction. It just seems
you're talking about film criticism. I think that Martin Scorsese would say you're not talking about the same kind of thing. Like you are talking about product criticism. These films are products in a way that film writ large is not. Like these are if this movie doesn't make $1 billion, we're ruined. Movies and like that's fucking insane that these have become the stakes. Like Martin Scorsese couldn't get a movie with fucking Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, and Al Pacino financed by anybody but Netflix. This is a commentary on how the film industry has changed, but like do not confuse these movies for film. And also, like, this is why, you know, Scorsese and Coppola back in the 70s would be like, oh, yeah, Spielberg and George, yeah, these great fucking movies, guys. And then, like, because of who came of age and became the people who are arbiters of culture, those movies are now considered, like, you know, the film canon. And I would say correctly because they completely changed the way, like, filmmaking worked. But, yeah, for me, like... To say, you know, we need to look at Star Wars the same way we look at fucking Uncut Gems or whatever is wrong. And I say that as an unabashed Star Wars fan.
Uncut Gems doesn't have adorable robots, I mean, obviously.
Well, it does have the Furby thing, though, that everybody flips out about in the trailer. I haven't seen the movie.
This is true.
So.
Haven't either. Sean, Star Wars? You gonna go see it with the youngins?
Younglings, they're called. Yeah. We're gonna go. probably gonna see it. Not, I don't think on the weekend, but maybe it might be like a Monday afternoon thing. So
well, there you go.
Looking forward to it. I have seen them all. Star Wars is a very big part of my childhood, but not so big that I have super strong feelings about how it all has to go. I like the last two. I thought they were fine. I thought a lot of the criticism of the second one was actually pretty accurate, even though a lot of it came from people I wouldn't normally want to find myself agreeing with, but also it had big cool moments and good lightsaber fights and all that stuff, so duels.
And I will my hill to die on is all the Luke shit in that movie. I think it's thematically correct and was really brilliant.
Yes, I agree. That was the best part of that movie by far. And again, like you want to talk about you know, studio decision making, like they were like, well, Luke has to die fighting Kylo Ren, and Ryan Johnson was like, that sucks though. Like, it doesn't make sense that he would. And so they had to like give him two endings at once. And it was like, oh, that kind of sucks.
And he's like, yeah, dies.
Yeah. Like, I'll show you they're dies. Gonna fucking, ugh. They're going to try – like the first third of this movie is just trying to convince you that this is the second movie in this trilogy is what I think is going to happen, and I'm going to be very mad about it.
It's a real James Cameron Terminator move where it's like, ignore all these other movies.
Yeah.
This is a direct link.
My favorite Star Wars thing of the last few days is that last week – my son, for the first time, got his face split open and had to go to the emergency room and get stitches.
Oh, my God.
He's fine. But after waiting for 5 hours, you finally get in and the doctor is stitching him up, and he had to get a lot. And they're just chatting. And the doctor was like asking him, like, you know, are you going to see Star Wars? And he's like, yeah, I saw the trailers. And the doctor's like, oh, I haven't seen the trailers. I don't watch them because of spoilers. And I then had to watch this dynamic of my 9-year-old son go, okay, but you know what was really cool? And the doctor who was literally stitching him up was like, no, seriously, don't tell me. And my kid is like, okay, but the one scene that was really great, and this increasingly, like, I could see his hands start to shake a little bit, and I'm like, I'm like, hey, little man, like, no, don't do this. And he's like, but I just want to tell him about the
cool
one thing.
And he gets it.
Yeah. But I also feel like he was about to like suddenly start like sewing my son's mouth shut if he didn't.
Yeah, like,
and eventually my son like blurted out. He's
Kylo,
like, just
ran at the beginning of.
Yeah.
He's the just, Last Jedi. Remember
like,
that?
Just at the last second, he just like he couldn't hold it in. He's like, that part where Rey does a backflip, and that was it. That was the part he wanted to get out. But the doctor like was he was like, you've just ruined the movie. Now that I know that Rey does a backflip, thanks a lot, me little.
That's hilarious.
But yeah,
my favorite Star Wars thing this week was that somebody deepfaked the video, the clip from Revenge of the Sith where Palpatine fights Yoda, and they deepfaked Baby Yoda into the movie.
Oh, God.
Instead of old Yoda, and it's just the Baby Yoda pod with little lightsaber sticking out of it fighting Palpatine. And I gotta tell you, it's fucking seamless. It's really well done. But it was by far my favorite thing I saw this week. All right, it's Puck Soup. Obviously, a Star Wars centric breakdown of the film coming up in a few weeks if we're all gonna see it. I'm Greg Wyshynski. You can go read my stuff at ESPN.com. The top 100 players of the decade list is on there right now. And you can listen to my other podcast, ESPN and Ice, where this week we talked to Rob Paulsen, a.k.a. the guy who did the voice of Raphael of the Ninja Turtles and Pinky in Pinky and the Brain. That was a real thrill for me.
Yeah, so check out all my stuff on Yahoo. Sign up for the Puck Soup newsletter that I do every week. Not decided when we're going to do the bonus Stick to Sports episode, either this weekend or next, but it will definitely be one of those two this month, so check it out.
You can find me on The Athletic. My piece this week about players you can't hate that we talked about is there. And if you're stuck for last-minute Christmas gifts, either a Athletic subscription is a really idea. If you go to theathletic.com/gift and you can buy it now, and then it'll get like delivered to them on Christmas morning. And also my book is still out there, and including an ebook and audio version if you're really down to the last minute stuff. So yeah, consider checking that out if you're looking for stuff at the last minute.
There it is. Get books, read, improve yourself. And we'll talk to you. Next week, special ep and a year episode. You know, you love it. And we'll see you then. Bye.
Later.
Bye.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to what if you commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hoggy and nonsense. Puck Soup.